From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Steve Zwemke, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state of South Dakota. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our segments podcast. Here's your weekly roundup in news coverage. The governor's State of the State marks the beginning of South Dakota's 2020 legislative session. This week's podcast brings you exclusive interviews and reporting from this first week in Pierre. Governor Kristi Noem highlighted expansion of high-speed internet services during the State of the State address Tuesday afternoon. She also outlined additional steps she wants to take this year to make South Dakota even more attractive to business.
To illustrate the importance of high-speed internet to small businesses, Governor Noem points to the Linderman family. As owners of the only grocery store in Timber Lake, 40 miles from the next grocery store, Noem explains they struggled without access to high-speed internet.
For them, that meant that they couldn't provide their customers with credit card, debit card, WIC, or EBT payment options. They even had to do all their orders for the store from somewhere else.
But after state and federal programs brought $25 million to expand internet services last year, Noem says the Lindermans are among more than 6,000 families who now have high-speed access.
We want to create an environment where people aren't forced to choose between the modern economy on one hand and life in their hometowns on the other.
But broadband isn't the only barrier to business. This year, Governor Noem is looking to improve housing options by opening the state's Ready Fund to support workforce housing projects.
Having suitable housing is economic progress. I'm confident that opening up this fund will get developers to invest in communities where additional housing units are the most needed.
The governor also discussed occupational licensing reform, retaining the state's graduates, and the upcoming South Dakota Week of Work. The inaugural program will give high school students a chance to explore job opportunities in their local communities. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jackie Hendry.
Lee Qualm represents District 21 and is House Majority Leader. Chris Langer represents District 25 and is Senate Majority Leader. The two joined Lori to discuss what they are hoping to see get done in 2020.
All right, so the Governor's State of the State address was heavy on business. Open for business. Let's talk about business. What are some of the things as lawmakers that you think when you hear that sort of rallying cry? I mean, she talked about business for a good portion of her State of the State address, obviously a priority. What comes to mind for you, Representative Qualm?
Well, I think one thing that she talked about is bioengineering. We talk about the next big thing. You know, what is that going to be? I think bioengineering has a tremendous potential. We've got some things happening with a couple of universities working together and moving forward. There's some industry that's excited about it. And that is a word that covers a whole gamut of things. And who knows where it could be, but I think it has tremendous potential to make some, you know, great things happen in South Dakota.
Are there things that you can do as a lawmaker? Is there legislation that can help in that effort? How do you sort of see that as far as plans going forward?
Well, I think you're going to see some legislation because, you know, obviously there has to be some funding that will come along with that. And I don't know exactly what that looks like yet. We're still talking about that. But in order to get a plan moving forward, we need to have some seed money to develop that plan so that we can keep going and working. And working with industry, within the state that is very excited about it. I think it has tremendous potential.
Yeah, and one of the things she said was a lasting infrastructure devoted to ag. And I'm sticking with you because you have such a strong farm background, right?
Yes, I do.
What does a lasting infrastructure with agriculture look like? When the governor says that, what does she mean?
Well, ag is number one in this state, and it always will be. I don't think we will never, ever get away from that. That is the background we have. And so with the precision ag that we did a couple of years ago, with the ADRDL that we got in place, the animal diagnostic lab, you know, where do we now we're making our crops better, we're doing more efficient at it, but what do we do with them? Where is it going to go? Now, obviously, animal agriculture, that is not going to stop. That's going to keep growing bigger and bigger and bigger. But there's other ways that we can use our products, our corn, our beans, our wheat, our cattle, our hogs. You know, where else can that go? And I think that's where bioengineering starts to come in and play a huge part of this. So this is another piece in that puzzle to help make our farmers more profitable and in turn bring business into South Dakota and in turn create more revenue for the state of South Dakota, more jobs.
Representative Langer, let's talk business, because you have a strong background in business as well. And one of the things Governor Noem leaned on was rural South Dakota and housing for businesses that are opening. When she says South Dakota is open for business, so what does that mean for you from a legislative standpoint where you think we can help move this forward? How?
Right. Well, one of the things that we really try to focus on is making sure that we're not restricting businesses any way, shape, or form, that they know that we're a safe place to come to. We're not all of a sudden going to have hidden fees or make it harder for them to have employers or that kind of thing. And so that's part of what we watch for a lot, and whatever we can do to make things easier for businesses and keep them wanting to come to South Dakota, know that this is a great place to work and raise their families. That's one of our key issues.
Housing seems like a really difficult thing to solve, a difficult challenge to solve.
Yes, for sure. You know, the governor talked about incentivizing some of those landowners to give them what they need to do, the tools that they need to build some affordable housing, because they do go hand in hand. If a large employer comes into your area, you need places for them to live. So they do go hand in hand.
Yeah. What else are you seeing from your party in general where people get together and say, these are some of our top issues? What are your priorities, Representative Langer?
Well, you know,
Senator Langer. I've been calling you Representative. Go ahead and correct me.
No,
Senator Langer.
That is totally fine. I was a representative at one time, so it's totally fine. No, I think, you know, for both of our caucuses, I think I can safely say funding is going to be our biggest priority. You know, we, in some ways, the governor probably did us a favor by having the big three at zero, because now we can only go up from there, and we will do our best.
You mean teachers, state employees, and
yes.
Reimbursement? Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking between both chambers that we all want to do better. We wish we could do even better than what our revenues are showing, but we need to stick within our budget as well.
Yeah. Representative Qualm, ideas on your priorities from the caucus?
Well, I will certainly agree with what Leader Langer said. We've already been having discussions between the chambers, and I think we're pretty aligned with that. We had WHIP meetings yesterday, and we're going to look at you know, the zeros, that's not acceptable. And I agree that I think the governor did us a favor, because we don't know what revenue is, and we can't even project right now. We need to have more numbers come in to really get a good feel for where we're at. But when we end up at the end of the day, things won't be zeros. I'm very confident in saying that. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be extremely difficult to do, but there's a will out there that we can do something.
Governor Noem also talked about legalizing hemp and some of the parameters that she thought would make an acceptable piece of legislation or legislative package. Those parameters seem reasonable to you? Do you think that there is room to get the legislative hemp to the governor's desk in a way that she feels she can sign it?
Sure. Leader Qualm probably is the more resident expert on hemp, but the four guardrails to me seem like, I think everybody is on board with that. We'll see. I mean, to me, they make sense, but we also need to, there's some funding that goes along with that, so that will be the challenge.
We're all back to funding, yeah. It's always a challenge. Did you have anything you wanted to add
about those
parameters?
The bill that we have in place is pretty much the parameters that they asked for, you know, the ones that, you know, the acre minimum, the paperwork, which we feel is extremely important, the permit process, all that stuff is there, just so everybody feels comfortable with it. The dollars, I think that's open for discussion as to what it is, you know. We're having those conversations about where we want to shake out on that. So I feel very confident that we're going to get to the end. You know, with Flandreau coming on board, knowing they're going to raise hemp. Standing Rock up in the northeast part, they grew some last year through North Dakota because their reservation extends up there. I know there's three other reservations that have applications in. we need to get this figured out, and we need to do it. Otherwise, it's going to make it extremely difficult if we don't have things in place. When we know within our borders we have reservations that are growing it, and then say that the rest of the farmers can't. I'm never going to say that this is the golden parachute, because I don't believe that. But I believe it's another opportunity for a brand new crop. We haven't had a new crop around for 50, 60, 70 years. You know, and the federal government has laid out some rules. The banking industry is online now, which they weren't before, and so there was some concern about that. Now they know that they can lend for hemp, whether it's for the production or whether it's the processing. Either way, so there's going to be huge changes taking. It's a tremendous industry, tremendous potential, and I certainly hope we can get it done.
You are the chair of the House State Affairs Committee, and I wanted to ask you about pacing, because House Bill 1057 is scheduled for a very early hearing in the House. Like, you know, first week we're ready to go. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow at 7:45 is what I've been told. And 1047, for folks who don't know, has to
1057.
Do 1057. Thank you. Describe that bill for people, if you can, in a very short.
Well, I will tell you right now that it's not going to be heard tomorrow because of the storm that's coming in. We have moved it back till Wednesday. And just because I didn't want to perceive that we were trying to do something out of the norm. If the weather was fine, we'd be hearing it tomorrow. But it's moved back till Wednesday. So we're trying to get that out that, hey, don't worry about it. I've talked to a lot of people who want to get that done. I know there's legislators that want to go home. And if they wait, they may not make it. Right. Sounds like Sioux Falls and that neck of the woods is not going to be a nice place to be on
Explain
Friday.
Explain that bill to people, though, and why you feel it's urgent to get on the docket first.
Well, not necessarily that it's urgent to get it on the docket. It was one that was ready. And so we just decided we were going to run it through. And the meeting on Wednesday, we're going to dedicate to the whole process. So
this is a bill that addresses transgender,
yes,
students, children, minors,
and
procedures that creates a felony for medical providers.
Yes.
That for,
yes,
people who don't know what we're talking about when we say House, yep, Bill 1057.
Yes.
And that leads me to you, Senator Langer. Sometimes we come in and, you know, the governor will get up and talk about business and we'll talk about agriculture, and then it seems the next conversation is a transgender conversation, an abortion conversation, the social issues that are also important. How do you balance as a leader these conflicting desires to say this is really important work in education and ag and business that we need to get done, but now all we're talking about is something else that is getting a lot of media attention, for example?
Right. It's always a challenge. There is no doubt. And there's always differing views on how much time you spend on something, how much effort you put into it, what solution are we trying to solve? So you'll see some differing viewpoints. That's for certain.
Yeah. Is that a struggle? Do you feel like some things can take over
yes,
an agenda and push things aside, and then at the end of the, it's such a short time that you're here.
Yeah. Unfortunately, some bills tend to get a life of their own, and
yeah,
and that is a struggle as leaders, because we have such a short time and we do have a lot of important work to get done. So to try to have that balance is a challenge at times.
Well, not rushing things and making sure people can actually get to peer to testify on important legislation to them. So
yeah,
these dueling,
yeah,
sort of needs, you know, move fast but not so fast that
right,
people don't feel like they've had their,
yeah,
say. Yeah.
We don't want that issue to consume the whole session, and I don't want him to consume that whole session. So those are two priorities that I have right now to get those moved through along with everything else. I don't want something one issue to do the whole session is not productive for anyone. So I felt if we could get these gone and Representative Deutsch had it ready to rock and roll, hey, let's do it, let's get it done, because there's going to be plenty of time for dialogue as it goes, because it has to, you know, go through committee, then go through the on the floor, you know, if it makes it out of committee, if it makes it out of there, it goes to the Senate committee. So there's a whole lot of processes that go through it. It'll have a fair hearing the whole way, but with the weather coming in and the conversation I was having with some of the people that wanted to be involved in that, I just felt for the first hearing it was not appropriate to do it when the eastern part of the state was in a blizzard warning. That just I just didn't feel that was the way to do it.
Any other priorities that you want to make sure to talk about today?
No, I don't.
Business, ag, get ready to go, work together, and make some progress. Here,
yes,
there.
Absolutely.
Now we'll take a listen to goals of the Democrats. Troy Heinert represents District 26 and is minority leader in the Senate. And Jamie Smith represents District 15 and is House Minority Leader.
Senator Heinert, since you are the senior leader in the room, let's start with you. How do you approach this session? What are some of the things that are top of the docket?
Well, sure. Thanks for having us today. And I think, you know, for Democrats, we want to come in and we want to focus on the things that we have control over or that we are mandated to have control over. We want to find increases for public education, community support providers, and state employees. Those are the big three. The governor had proposed a 0% increase, and you know that I don't think that's just going to fly in this legislative session. You know, 0% actually means we're going backwards, and that's not something legislature wants to see happen.
Yeah, where do you begin with that conversation? Everyone knows it's important. Governor addressed it in her State of the State and said she kind of opened the door a little bit and said there's a little more, we have a little more information than we did when I did the budget address, and we maybe have some wiggle room. What's next?
So talking to appropriators is first off. You know, right now we're looking at about $22 million that has come in since the budget address. You know, to fund CPI, that's about $34 million to give that 2%. So, you know, we're going to find it. I think with a 0% budget, it gives us a chance to say this is going to be our number. And we can come in right away at the start of session and kind of almost work backwards as before in each session. We're trying to reach this target. I think this has given the legislature an opportunity to say, this is our number. How do we get there?
Representative Smith, would you say the governor, the Republicans, the Democrats, everybody seems to be mentioning that this is a priority, which is not a promise, but it is a hint that this is something that everybody's on the same page for?
You know, yeah, everybody I've talked to, everywhere I've been, that has been the message from everyone. I guess what we'll wait to see and what we're really pushing for is we don't want just lip service on that. We really want to see it. Mm-hmm. And you know, as us in the super minority, we can try to influence the conversation here, but we really, really need those folks to step up and really mean it. And so we're going to hold their feet to the fire on that.
When we talk about priorities, we asked Representative Qualm about House Bill 1057, which is a legislation. The hearing was scheduled for tomorrow. Now it's been delayed, according to him, partially because of the weather, so people can make sure they get the full involvement. And we talked a little bit about these issues. This one is a transgender-related issue. There's other talk about abortion legislation and how some issues can kind of take over, take the oxygen. And so speak a little bit about that, if you will. What I think I can, I don't like to make generalizations, but broadly call social issues, can they overrun the short time that you have? Or are they just as important as every other piece of legislation about business and housing and appropriations, and just make sure that we deal with them all appropriately?
The first thing I'll say is that legislation that's brought forward to us here is always important to someone. All right, no matter what the bill. So there's somebody that's a priority for. Now, as a general whole for our thing, these what you would call social bills are ones to push. It's an election year. We got to remember that. And there are people out there that are trying to push nationals' agendas and really drive wedges here. You know, and personally, I don't like any of those bills that we bring forward that aren't really trying to solve problems that exist here in the state of South Dakota. That being Bill 1057, I don't believe that's an issue here in the state of South Dakota. And I was talking to so many people yesterday, actually, and thank you to Leader Qualm. We had a conversation about that. We want to make sure that there's a fair hearing on that. And with the weather coming into Sioux Falls and with, you know, it affects physicians in a huge way, they have clinics scheduled. I mean, you can't just, if you're a physician, you can't just say, oh, sorry, I'm not going to be able to be in clinic because I've got to go to peer. But if you have a few days, you might be able to move a few things around and clear your schedule. So moving that to Wednesday, I'm grateful for that because we're going to be able to, I think, show that bill is not necessary in the state of South Dakota.
I also asked the Republican leadership about the hemp and the guardrails that Governor Noem and Senator Heinert, maybe you want to address that. Do you think those guardrails are going to be, is this something that the lawmakers and the governor can come together on this session, not able to come together last session on industrial hemp?
Well, I think the hemp bill that they brought forward is just a very well-written bill. That summer study, you know, the bipartisan summer study did a great job of going out to other states and seeing what works in their area, getting some costs on how they implemented their program. You know, and we can't just do exactly what Kentucky does, or we can't even do exactly what North Dakota does. But I think it gives us an opportunity to use the knowledge that's already there and then create our own plan. As far as the pillars, I would think that most of them are in the bill already. The only thing that I see maybe the big contentious issue is that the governor thinks it's going to be $3.5 million to get this plan rolling. I don't think it's near that number. So I guess it's really going to be up to the legislature to prove that we can do this for a small amount of tax dollars and then see what the market would provide. You know, we did have a game changer in South Dakota. Flandreau got approved by the USDA to grow and harvest industrial hemp. I know other tribes in the state have applications at USD or at the USDA, and we definitely have to figure out the transportation piece of this, because if those products leave the reservation, get on state highways, and they're stopped, though they are legal federally, they'd be violating state law, and then that, I think, could get ugly.
State of the Tribes address this afternoon, and I'm sorry I don't have the title of the other address, the address, the Great Sioux Nation.
Great Sioux Nation, correct.
What to listen for during those two addresses? What do you think, Senator Hyde?
Well, I think, you know, Lester Thompson, chairman from Fort Thompson, is giving this address, and I think you'll hear from him some
he's
of the...
He's giving the Great Sioux Nation address.
He's giving the State of the Tribes address.
Okay, thank you.
I think you'll hear from him some of the cooperation that his tribe and the state of South Dakota have worked on, some public safety agreements. You know, they're relatively close to peer, so I think they have a pretty good working relationship. They have a lot of members who actually live in Fort Thompson but work in the Fort Peer area. So I think we'll hear some of that. I think we'll hear some of the challenges that his tribe faces, and a lot of those challenges are the same going across Indian country, you know, housing, infrastructure, economic development, and then methamphetamine abuse, and how do we combat that. I think the Great Sioux Nation address, that's going to be a little less formal and give a chance for each tribal representative to kind of talk about the issues that they're facing, or how the state can have a positive impact or a partnership with them.
Mm-hmm. Representative Smith, Jason Roundsburg, South Dakota Attorney General, is going to be on during our second hour, and we're going to ask him about the legislature from Virginia, which ratified the Equal Rights Amendment yesterday. There are some legal hurdles to what happens next that Roundsburg is going to address, but I'm wondering if the legislature of South Dakota was asked to ratify the ERA today in this legislative session or not. What kind of conversations do you think? And you're making that face that no one can see.
I'm sorry, that wasn't on my radar. It's not anything we've been talking about. I don't know if Senator Heinert's heard anything either.
I haven't heard anything on the Senate side.
Nothing at
other
all.
Other than just what we've kind of read in the papers. It was kind of a surprise to us.
I think everybody's taken by the face that I'm referring to for radio listeners is one of surprise. Of what are we even talking about here?
Yeah.
Let's get our feet under us with what's happening next.
Yep.
Final thoughts in our remaining few minutes about other priorities that you're really hoping to make traction on this legislative session.
You know, you're going to see us with some issues that we've been talking about for a very long time in the Democratic Party. And one of those things that you're going to see is a push again for a pre-K advisory council. We really just, you know, it's a part of that whole public education package, and there are many kids across our state that we know aren't receiving that early intervention and education to help them be ready for school. And so that advisory council is going to be a really important piece. Mm-hmm. Also, things that we, you know, are still really concerned about, nursing homes. You know, we got one bite of the apple last year, but it's going to be multiple bites till we get to where we need to be to provide the proper funding to take care of our elderly population in our state, and it's a growing population in our state.
How urgent is that situation when we talk about, you know, raising, you know, giving increases to teachers, which is a top priority for everyone, and then a lot of what Governor Noem said about business, and then you have, you know, the idea of pre-K, and then you have these nursing homes. That's a lot.
There's a lot
to go around. Yeah.
And you're exactly right. I just know that when the cost of having a Medicaid patient in your nursing home is $180 a day, and the state was giving you $137 a day, that's not enough. And we got that up, but it's not there, and we know that. So we have to be creative, and we have to do those things, but we also have to make sure that those are our priorities as well. Mm-hmm. It's a tough job. Another thing that we need to do, and it's a tough thing to do, but we got to look at revenue. How, you know, we lost when we the internet tax going away, we lost $30 million of state, 20 for state government, 10 for local governments. That's money that has not been replaced with anything yet. So we've always had a hard time finding those resources, and now it's even harder.
And most people thought that was a real gain to get rid of that tax or to add that tax because – so explain to people why
it's
a
loss. Well, I want you to look at your cable bill, and if that $6 really came back to you and it's in your pocket and you're going to spend that in the local economy and it's your money – I mean, that's always the argument is the government shouldn't have that money. We should have that money to spend that money. Well, we have to raise revenues in some way, and so that's one – that I personally was willing to pay that extra $6 if it helps us here. We'll see if that changed your bill.
Senate Minority Leader Troy Hinert and House Minority Leader Jamie Smith, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Representatives from several tribal governments in the Northern Plains hope the first annual Great Sioux Nation Address unifies Ojibwe Shakowin once again. The historic meeting comes as the South Dakota State Legislature kicks off its 2020 session. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Before tribes in the Northern Plains were split up into reservations, Rosebud Sioux Tribal Chairman Rodney Bordeaux says the tribes would counsel together in the past. It was a strong coalition of Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota tribes, he says.
But this will, the Ojibwe Shakowin, the reunification of that will just make us stronger in terms of getting what we need to get done, serving our peoples, and making us, the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota, a strong nation again. And it's possible. So we just laid the groundwork for it again. I know a lot of my ancestors that have gone on before me always wanted to do this, so I'm just playing a small part in making this happen, and it's going to happen.
Representatives from tribal governments within the states of South and North Dakota and Montana all attended. A lot of the issues brought up by different representatives were similar, from infrastructure to human trafficking, the infiltration of meth, and the shortfalls of health care. Treaty rights were also a central topic. Lower Brule Sioux Tribal Chairman Boyd Gourneau was first elected to that tribal council in 1987. He says he's never seen unity as it exists now.
But, you know, I just don't like it when they put us in situations where we're at a constant struggle, just a survival at our own reservations, where we don't have time to do what we're doing now, unified. And that's what we need, and that's what we need to do moving forward, I hope.
South Dakota state lawmakers say they'd like to meet with tribal representatives again to discuss how the state and tribes can work together. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Fort Pierre.
More than 40 State House Republicans are sponsoring a bill that creates a Class 4 felony against a medical professional who may change or affirm the perception of a minor's sex. Critics say the legislature has more important issues to tackle rather than discriminating against a group of individuals. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
House Bill 1057 slaps a Class 4 felony on medical professionals who attempt to change a minor's sex, either by puberty-blocking medication or surgeries like castration, mastectomy, hysterectomy, phalloplasty, etc. Leading the charge on what supporters call the Vulnerable Child Protection Act is Representative Fred Deutsch. He brought a so-called bathroom bill in 2016, which passed through the legislature, but was vetoed by then-Governor Dennis Dugard. The Florence Republican says the bill is needed because people are getting hurt. He calls the procedure child abuse and says it's akin to genital mutilation.
We don't allow mutilation of our children in South Dakota. Even upon parent approval, we do not allow parents to approve or permit their children to be mutilated or abused.
Deutsch says South Dakota protects its children. Sioux Falls Democratic Representative Linda Duba opposes the legislation. She spent 25 years at Citibank. She says legislation like this proves to multinational companies that the state might not be as tolerant as it can to attract business.
And I don't think that the government has the right to be making decisions for minors. I think that's what family is for. I think that's what parents are doing. And I think that this is an unnecessary bill that's just going to generate fear, anger, and hate, and divide us.
The ACLU South Dakota says the legislation only stands to harm transgender kids and families and make their lives harder. The bill has not been scheduled for a hearing. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre.
South Dakota Supreme Court Chief Justice David Gilbertson delivered his 19th and final State of the Judiciary address Wednesday. SDPB's Stephanie Rissler brings us this special report.
This is Chief Justice Gilbertson's 19th and final State of the Judiciary to lawmakers.
I spent much time talking about the UJS problem-solving courts and alternative sentencing programs, drug courts, DUI courts, veterans treatment courts, mental health courts, and the HOPE program. We all agree that people who commit crimes should be held accountable and the public safety protected. However, we also need to be realistic enough to deal with the underlying cause of what got them into the criminal justice system in the first place.
Gilbertson says ignoring the underlying cause makes the criminal justice system a revolving door. He says a cure isn't always achieved, but he says UJS reformed laws passed by the legislature have made a difference. Now he says it's time to look for new opportunities to help people.
The UJS is exploring the concept of incorporating mental telehealth services into the judicial system. We have discussed establishing mental telehealth services with law enforcement entities that are not large enough to have direct local access to these kinds of services. When I discussed this idea with Walter Panzerer, the trustee of the Helmsley Charitable Trust, we thought it would be worthwhile to see if this concept could be expanded to provide mental telehealth services to others in the criminal justice system. Governor Noem has agreed to also participate in a study of this proposal.
Gilbertson says it could help defense attorneys dealing with clients, judges, and providing better proceedings, and court service officers with tools to better supervise prisoners with mental health issues. As Gilbertson reflects on the accomplishments and changes during his tenure, he stresses South Dakota cannot return to the brick-and-mortar institutions the state once operated. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Stephanie Rissler in Pierre.
Following that report, David Gilbertson joined Lori this Thursday to further elaborate where he believes South Dakota has improved and where there is still work to be done.
Emotional day for you to do that finally? I mean, you've got a lot of days of work ahead of you, but yet this is a symbolic moment as well.
It was emotional. It was trying to tell the legislature and the people of South Dakota where during my stewardship as Chief Justice we have improved the situation, what has evolved. Because if you look at the society when I became chief in 2001, totally different time than it is today. Yeah. Try to report where we've succeeded and where I see future challenges ahead that will need to be addressed.
In fact, you went back and looked at your first address to really dig into what were some of those things that you were saying, and that the difference between then and now was stark for you. Expand on that a little bit, please.
Well, everything I talked about yesterday, all the subjects, none of those were in the 2002 message.
Hmm.
Drug issues were minimal. The real attorney hadn't come up yet. And so it was clearly a different time.
One of the things in the address that I think is on that list of things people don't think about had to do with the tornado in Burke and emergency judicial power,
mm-hmm.
and how that was sort of tested for the first time. Walk us through a little bit of what happened, what unfolded, and why it's significant to sort of figure out right now, because it's going to happen in the future.
It will. The only question is when. When there was concern during the Rounds administration that there was a pandemic threat to where you could have whole areas of the state disabled, you know, government institutions can't function. I got a law passed through the legislature that said that the Supreme Court had authority to, if you couldn't operate a courthouse in Gregory County, you could move it to Tripp County so that the court operations would continue. And we never had a pandemic at that time. We were lucky. Well, then we hit the floods in 2011, and we came very close to shutting down the Stanley County Courthouse and I think one of them down by Yankton because they could be flooded. It didn't happen. We got lucky again. And then along comes the tornado at Burke, destroys the school, the end of it that's only 200 feet away from the courthouse, blows out all the windows, the doors. All of our records are now electronic, and there was no electricity, and the building was pretty well devastated at that point. So we moved the authority to operate a court system from Gregory next door to Tripp County. Didn't know how long it would take to get it up and running again, and they did a marvelous job down there cleaning up all the busted glass, getting the electricity back on. I drove down there, talked to the county commission, talked to the presiding judge, and they said, we think we are ready to open back up. So I went back to the Supreme Court and said, okay, let's transfer this back to Gregory County. And we did. Nobody got hurt. The duration was fairly short, and it was a really good trial run. You could get a way more serious incident, a tornado that leveled a courthouse or a huge flood or any kind of natural disaster or a man-made disaster. And so it was a good primer as to what we will need to do, not if a disaster strikes, but when.
Mm-hmm. What happens when those services shut down?
For
people who use them. Put that in context for people who don't spend a lot of time, you know, they don't go down to their county courthouse unless they need to, you know, get their license plate or something.
Right.
So they don't have a sense of how devastating an interruption in service can be.
You have people that are sitting in jail that are facing criminal charges. Well, if you can't run a court system, what happens to them? That would be the most obvious. People that maybe need to file documents, you know, statute of limitations may be running on a lawsuit they need to file. Well, if the courthouse isn't open, you can't file it. So you have to have somewhere where they can file it. And so those are basic core functions that that we need to provide to the public on a continual basis.
Yeah. Were there lessons for the future for you?
I guess no. It was more of a trial run, and it went well.
There was some reassurance there that, yes, this mattered, and, yes, we know how to do it, and we're ready.
Yes.
So, yeah. Talk to us a little bit about South Dakota being the lone state to include Indian law on the bar exam. That is another initiative that you've been very outspoken about.
Well, at one point, most of the lawyers in South Dakota really were not well-versed in Indian law. And as the tribes evolve, they become more sophisticated in their business relations. They have more contacts with governmental entities outside the reservation. I don't know in South Dakota how you can practice law and say, well, I don't need to know Indian law. Sooner or later, there's going to be a case that comes into that lawyer's office or business that they're working for where they need to know Indian law. And I think it's basic, just like a doctor would need to know the basics of a lot of parts of the body and anatomy. And so what I did was I came up with the idea that, well, if you, when you take the bar exam, have to study for and pass a exam on Indian law, you'll retain it for the future. Like riding a bike, you kind of remember it. And that's now been in operation since 2005. It's worked very well. We've had no problems with it. We have review courses for students that need the review courses before they take the test. And then if they become members of the South Dakota Bar, they have that knowledge. And
plus it sets a priority for them. If you're taking the test and someone says it is important for you to study this, even if you don't retain the actual knowledge and have to go refresh it, it's setting a marker saying this matters.
You will know how to identify it and where to look it up.
Yeah.
That's key. Hmm.
Another thing that it seems that has been a part of your tenure here, and I want to tie this into the recent history, is yesterday the Virginia legislature ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, and in your address talked about women on the bench and how very early on you were saying it, you know, judges ought to look like the people that they represent.
Right.
When was that radical at the time?
It kind of was. When I got out of law school, the judge I practiced in front of in Sisseton was Judge Mildred Remeike, the only female judge in South Dakota. It's history at that time. And she was a great judge, great role model, to where she convinced me that maybe that was a career path for me to be a judge. She's one of my heroes, and I don't have that many. Well, then she retired, and I was chosen to replace her, so we went from one female judge to none, because they put me in her place. But slowly, more women were graduating from law school, so they became into the pool for judges. When I became chief, we had 6 out of 41 judges, trial judges, that were women. Now it's 18. We had no women on the Supreme Court then, now 2 of 5. And each judicial circuit is run by a presiding judge. There's 7 judicial circuits, and 3 of the 7 are run by female judges. Hmm. So I think maybe the best thing I can say about it is it used to be a big deal when a woman was appointed as a judge. No, it's just a matter of course. It's no big deal because it's commonplace, and that's maybe where we've arrived, where we should be.
Yeah, but it took leadership to get there.
Yes.
And quite a bit of that leadership was yours.
Well, I don't know about that. I certainly encourage.
I can say it. Maybe you.
Okay. I will say I did encourage and met with each governor I worked with to encourage that.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it takes somebody on the inside in the seat to make the encouragement. To help people understand that it matters.
I did that.
Yeah. Criminal justice is an ongoing conversation. Senate Bill 70 and the juvenile justice reform are things that you mentioned. And you said very specifically it is not the time to go backwards. Not everything is perfect. We're not done going forwards. We're not settled here. What are some of the ways? Because I think sometimes people in a community who have a problem and remember, the problem might have been solved by this route, this brick-and-mortar place that isn't here anymore. What are some of the avenues for those things that are still being talked about to move forward? How do people reach out and move forward instead of asking for something that that we let go of for a reason?
Well, Senate Bill 70 was passed in 2013, so it's 7 years old. And we didn't have a crystal ball. We wrote that bill based on the needs at the time. We did knew things were going to change. I mean, society always changes. And so we had a group, a committee to oversee those changes and make recommendations. Unfortunately, it sunsetted after 5 years and doesn't exist anymore. So I think maybe that committee should be recreated because things have changed significantly between the issues we face in 2020 and what they faced back in 2015. Same for the juvenile companion bill. And that does have an oversight committee that is still effective, and they're actively meeting, and they are talking about proposing some changes to the legislature as far as the juvenile side. I see that as an ongoing continual process because society is going to evolve, therefore the challenges will evolve, and therefore probably the laws need to evolve too to meet that.
Attorney General Raunsberg is going to be on the program a little bit later. We'll ask him about presumptive probation because this is one of his legislative priorities to revise. From your perspective, what are some of the critical thinking questions that we need to ask ourselves when we talk about things like presumptive probation based on where we've been and where you would like to see the judicial system in South Dakota head?
Well, it's a public policy decision to be made by the legislature. They made it when they passed Senate Bill 70. The Supreme Court, sooner or later, if they make changes in the law, will be required to interpret those changes as appeals come up to us. So it's probably not appropriate for me to now talk about my wish list. It's under our judicial rules. We wait until a case comes to us, and then we decide it.
Lawmakers have stepped up, and you acknowledge them for things like the work they've done on elder abuse, which was something else that was very important to you. Are there other important things that you take away and say, you know, these are either my priorities for this legislative session or things that you look back on and say, these are times where we really got it right?
I think, looking into the past, that we did as good as we could on drug courts, alcohol courts, veterans courts, the mental health courts. They seem to be working well. People accept them as part of the criminal justice system now, and I think we've had some very positive results. As far as what I would like to see in the future, I would like to see a wholesale adoption of telehealth into the criminal justice system, where if an officer picks up somebody at 2 a.m. in the morning in a rural area and looks at them and say, something's not right here, that officer can then access through an iPad or a computer a mental health professional to give that officer some advice as to what to do. And let's run it all the way through the criminal justice system. When that person comes in, do you bond them out or don't, based on concerns over their mental health? Well, once again, let's use telehealth. When he gets a defense attorney, the defense attorney is trying to decide, what kind of a client do I have here? Well, maybe that defense attorney can use telehealth. When the case comes in front of the judge is trying to decide various legal issues. Maybe the judge benefits from that telehealth access. If there's a criminal sentence to be made, the judge benefits from the telehealth as far as what's an appropriate criminal sentence. If the person is then placed on probation, the probation officer can do more effective supervision if that probation officer has access to telehealth. If we can put that together, we will revolutionize the way that we do the criminal justice system in South Dakota for the better, because we have estimates that I would say in the area of 20% of the people that come into the criminal justice system have underlying mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I noticed about Governor Noem's State of the State address, I think, maybe I'm off here, but it perked my ears up. And when you were just listing drug court and veterans court and mental health court, I remember a time when, you know, people were just called criminals. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of very specific things that she said when she talked about suicide, or she talked about, you know, mental health issues, or she talked about, you know, addiction issues. We're not putting people in these big categories that I think we used to put people into. And once again, it seems like that partially goes back to this idea of here's a veterans court. When you hear that, you immediately realize that there's a human being behind that procedure. And in this case, it happens to be a veteran. When you hear drug court or DUI court, it's specific. Do you see what I'm getting at there? Do you think we're better at not brushing people with big strokes and saying bad guys and good guys?
Absolutely. People are charged with criminal offenses, but we finally woke up and say, why were they charged with a criminal offense? Well, maybe because they were a drug addict. That's why they're in possession of drugs or stole to get money for drugs. Or they're an alcoholic. Or they're a veteran that comes back with PTSD from Afghanistan and is attempting to self-medicate that PTSD by alcohol or drug usage. And if you don't deal with the underlying cause of what got them into the criminal justice system in the first place, they're going to get released. Nobody stays in prison for life unless it's for murder. And when they get released, they're still got that addiction or that PTSD. Guess what? It's going to happen again and again and again. A revolving door syndrome. And our prisons are full. We don't need to keep rotating people endlessly through the system. It's the classic Einstein definition of insanity. Keep doing the same thing over and over again and hoping for a different change or a different result. So that's what I think that's one major accomplishment we have done is how do we make this person who is now in the criminal justice system after they serve their sentence or whatever it is into a productive citizen instead of a continued addict.
It's been a life work for you.
Well, it is. I mean, as I said yesterday, sending somebody to prison and not treating them for a drug or alcohol addiction makes about as much sense as sending somebody suffering from cancer to that prison and expect them to be released cancer-free. It doesn't happen.
Ben Jones is South Dakota's Secretary of Education. He joined Lori and Pierre with a look into his priorities.
Welcome back, Secretary Jones. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. Good morning.
As you look at legislative priorities for this session, and as you look at just the data that you've been able to gather, one of the things that you've led with is the opportunity gap. It's stark. Explain what you mean by the opportunity gap and who's affected by it, and how big is that?
Sure.
How big is that gap? Why did it become the thing for you that you said this is so urgent that we need to talk about this first?
Well, when you look through the numbers and you try to peel back the different pressure points or the different groups of students who, if they improved, would make a meaningful difference across the state at the state level number. So looking at proficiency scores of and what the state has tracked for many years now has been fourth grade reading, eighth grade math, Native American improvement, and high school graduation and attendance in various ways. So the test that we've been using at the state level for the past 3 years now has subgroups. You can see how boys do and girls do. You can see how Native American kids do and middle class kids do, and all these different subgroups that the federal government wants us to report. And when you look through the subgroups and you see, okay, what's the average, and then how are the subgroups doing against that average? And when you make the realization that race and all of these things that are outward appearance make no difference on anybody's intelligence, then you begin to realize, okay, with a well-prepared teacher, any kid can learn. And that's been shown. So if you have those two assumptions, you go in and then you look at literally at across the state level, thousands of kids who would be proficient in 11th grade math and English and be more prepared for college, then you realize you really are, if you're not reaching them, we are building in what we're calling the opportunity gap for them.
It's the system.
Well, it may be the system, or it's the mix of, again, there's no real one.
No magic button.
No magic button. Yeah. But what are the things that you could do? And so the biggest group, the biggest single group, is those living in economically disadvantaged homes. I think the number, it's about a third of all the South Dakota students meet that criteria. And we judge that by, are they on free and reduced lunch? Which is kind of a clumsy way to do it, but nevertheless, that's where the data is. So that's where we said, okay, we define the line as those children on free and reduced lunch. What are the things that are holding them back, that if they were not on free and reduced lunch, they'd be doing better on average again? So then what are the strategies that we can do to prepare teachers for that type of student, whether it's on Pine Ridge, I was there last week visiting those kids, or whether it's kids in, say, Dakota Valley that might be on free and reduced lunch, which is one of the more affluent districts. So that same problem exists across there. How can the teacher teach to that type of child with that type of family life and those things going on outside the school? How can the principal create an environment in that school? What can the Department of Education do when it's thinking about certification, when it's thinking about accreditation, when it's thinking about the things that we do in the department to think about that student in particular? So we've had we put out a call over email to see which school districts would want to participate in that, and within 48 hours, I had 40 emails saying, "Pick me, pick me! I'd like to be on that team." And so we have a wide variety of school districts. Rapid City, Sioux Falls are participating, but as so is Oglala Lakota, so is Sisseton, so is Wagner, Huron, Hoven, Belfouche. So we've got a geographic spread, large enrolled schools, low enrolled schools, as far as population goes, and we've met a couple times just to kind of frame the issue. And I've taken them through, well, some of those slides that you probably saw were some of the slides I used with that group. We're also including people who you wouldn't necessarily think would be a part of the conversation. We've got Board of Regents, which you would think would be a part of that conversation, but other people wanted to join us. So we have Lutheran Social Services, we have Parent Connection, which is a nonprofit in Sioux Falls that helps connect parents to educational issues and support for their kids. The National Guard commander wanted to participate. He believes there's a lot of things about education that are important to National Guard members. And I said, sure, General Millett, if you want to come, that'd be great. And various school groups and lobbying groups, SDA is a part of that. Yeah. So we've kind of framed the issue. Session is here. We may take a bit of a pause, but now we're going through the data to try and figure out among the things that we're beginning to talk about. We've got some categories of ideas. And we're going to begin to kind of frame those ideas out to figure out what's the biggest impact that we could do.
When people ask what's different about this effort than efforts in the past to close an income gap, mm-hmm. one of the things that would come to mind for me would be the data. That we have access to information that we just didn't have before, not only in South Dakota, but mm-hmm. you know, research and beyond.
Right.
What else makes this different?
You put your finger on it. I think that's probably the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. I think then we have all that time spent too. And you know, you're familiar with some of my past background, more than just higher ed, but I think I spoke about this last year. Yeah. Throwing money at problems that the United States has done around the world in various places for economic development and so forth never works. It has to be from the grassroots. You have to do what's sustainable and what the local school district will think will work, what they will get passionate behind to work. Good ideas coming from Pierre or from Washington or from wherever only go so far, and then when the money runs out, it ends. That good idea is over. So we really want to have that discussion. That's why I thought it was really important to include the school districts, but have it kind of organized from the department level. And then if people have good ideas or bright spots that they've implemented and have seen work in practice, then we can try to understand what are the conditions why that's worked, mm-hmm. Learn from the failures as well as the anatomy of what makes that work. And say, Belfouche, can that good idea be transformed to Hoven or Wagner or something?
Right. Seems like in South Dakota too, we have the challenges that we have, mm-hmm. being geographically broad and low population, and mm-hmm. Not a cash-rich state with money to just fuel into programs. Mm-hmm. But we also have a lot of advantages in the sense of that connectivity and that ability to say this low population means something. There's a sense of optimism that we can in fact get our arms around something.
There's a can-do attitude, absolutely. And there's also one of your comments made me think. A lot of the superintendents that are a part of this have experience in other districts too. They may have grown up in that district. They got a job in a different district, and I remember working on that issue in McLaughlin or wherever, and this is that it worked there, but I don't know that it'll work where I'm at now. And so they recognize that, and that has a role to play.
Tell me about the knowledge-rich curriculum,
because
that's something that is a new sort of terminology for people. Mm-hmm. I think I know what that means, mm-hmm. but how are you defining that?
Well, we are churning away on a solid definition for that right now. I think one of the things that has gone on in the department since the Browns administration was putting in higher standards, which has caused a lot of consternation and concern, because we raised the standards and the scores went down. that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. I think now, though, the piece that was missing was we raised the standards and we didn't think about, and at the state level, I'm not empowered to think about curriculum. So I think the assumption was, to the extent that, that it was thought about, if we raise the standards, that the school districts will take a look at their curriculum and have curriculum that meets the standards and is also rich and engaging and rewarding for students. All the educational research and literature shows that when students are engaged, and how a student is engaged is really determined by the classroom teacher, because she knows her students or he knows her students, and how they're going to keep that going. So picking that curriculum is really needs to be done at the local level and the classroom level. I have no aspirations or ambitions to get into that discussion at the local level. But I think that we, the department, can, in the coming couple of years, begin to think about knowledge-rich curriculum that helps a teacher teach to the standard. I was at a, with one of my kids, I was at a public school, and this was 2 or 3 years ago, for a speech contest. And around the walls of the classroom were the standard. And I had just come from working on the social studies standards, and we were told these standards aren't or shouldn't be what the kids are reading and working with. They should have curriculum that meets the standard, mm-hmm. that helps them understand how to know and do those things in the standard. The standard is not the curriculum. Mm-hmm. But when I walked in that classroom and I saw the words around the room, ringing the room, they were almost like the wallpaper of the classroom. I said, I think this teacher is really struggling for good curriculum because she or he is teaching the standard. And the standard is boring. Boring.
Not the most inspiring words
no.
for a classroom.
So I don't know what those little kids thought was going on, but they, if that teacher was struggling to get them engaged, and if that's exactly what was going on, if she was teaching, he or she was teaching the standard, then that is not knowledge-rich curriculum, because there is no, very little facts, evidence, detail, data in that standard. That information all resides in the curriculum. And then you use those facts, knowledge, details, data to perform analysis as you get into middle school and high school and so forth. You start thinking about, well, why does this occur? What makes this happen?
Secretary Ben Jones, thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Jason Roundsburg is South Dakota's Attorney General. Roundsburg holds the power of attorney in representing South Dakota in all legal matters. He joined Lori to talk about what he believes should be top of mind for our legislators in 2020.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. It's good to be back.
Let's talk about what's happening in South Dakota today and some of your legislative priorities. And you and I
I've already been to committee.
And you and I have discussed some of this before, and I want to bring people up to date and then talk about moving these conversations forward. And one of them is a Senate bill for the missing persons clearinghouse. Progress on that and some legislation.
Right.
Give people a quick background. It kind of starts with this missing and murdered Indigenous people, and you've been very clear that all missing persons in South Dakota, we can do better with how we deal with those cases.
Absolutely. Our office was charged in 1986 with finding missing and murdered people in all varieties. And then last year, of course, SB 164 keyed in on murdered and missing Indigenous people. And so I think it's been a very positive development. I've went out and I've talked to a number of our Native American tribes as well. As you probably remember, there was a lady found in the lake here last year, and she'd been missing for about 2 years, and nobody had reported her missing. So it's obviously very hard to find someone, and you don't know that you should be looking for them. I came into office, I looked at our website and some of our resources, and quite frankly, we had the same 7 people on a database of missing people. And I said, well, we need to get updated with that. And then last year, like I said, the bill came through. I thought that was a very positive step. And so today's bill was SB 27. And it did pass committee, so I'm very happy about that. 7-0, unanimous. And I think they said it'll go to the consent calendar, so we're very happy that we're moving through the process. But I think that will give us some more resources. It'll give DCI, which works for me, our Division of Criminal Investigation, more resources to get out to the public. Because all the statistics show it's in those first hours, those first few days, that you have the best success of finding people. And sometimes it's just a matter of some people have just moved away and they don't want to, you know, move on. But it's a way if we can link together and get awareness out there. I know one sheriff told me that, you know, a son moved away to Minnesota, but he came up on a speeding ticket or something. So he wasn't really gone. He just moved away. But I think we build awareness for that. And then obviously there's cases that we get a lot of good awareness, you know, like the Serenity case out in Rapid City. I mean, it's got a lot of attention, but a lot of cases don't get the attention like that. And we want to try and get people involved as much as we can.
The woman found in the lake, what was her name?
I don't
and that's part of this process, right? And I
yep.
say that for the point because I don't know the answer to that either. And part of the process is you have people who are missing, who are found, who are essentially nameless. And this is attempting to change not only the justice that's served, but the identification of who these people are.
Well, I do. I think it gives people also, I mean, sadly, if we find them and they are deceased, that it does at least give closure to the family and their community and, you know, try and helps us solve that.
How does that change things in reservation on tribal lands than with DCI efforts?
I think it'll be a very positive step that they already are connected to some systems. I think we can reach out more and have more community involvement. I know I've been to Sisseton, I've been to Rosebud, you know, I've talked with them. I want to open those lines of communication even further than they already are, and so that we can get more awareness that these people are missing. I do not care if you're on the reservation or off the reservation. I'm trying to find everyone that's missing.
Let's talk about presumptive probation. Another thing we've discussed before, it was important to you during the campaign. Tell me a little bit about what you're hoping this legislative session will achieve regarding presumptive probation.
Well, I think the first thing last year that we achieved is we got a greater discussion going about it. And I hope that that will continue this year. And I guess I'm more resolved that the voice is getting louder, that it doesn't work. And so we are trying to figure ways to make it work better. I've always been for a carrot and a stick approach. I very much support the governor's initiatives here where she's trying to have more treatment, more options. I think they put around $3.7 million into more treatment options. I definitely think that we need more treatment options. But I do believe that, you know, we need cooperation, too. We need people that are willing to cooperate and work with us so we can move up the chain. And we have been doing that, but it takes a lot more steps now because of presumptive probation. And, you know, there's no incentive to work with law enforcement. And we want people working with us to improve their lives, but also to take the drug dealers out of their communities. So we've brought one bill that seeks to address that. Another bill, it's kind of a three strikes, kind of like you do when you get an ag assault now or a DUI. As your conduct continues to be worse and worse as you go down the road, there are more and more consequences with a DUI or a simple assault.
This is a 10-year look back?
10-year look back. Okay. That's modeled right
so
off of the DUI.
Yeah, give me an example of how that works.
So what happens is if you get convicted in a DUI situation, if you get a first, you know, it's a misdemeanor. Second's misdemeanor, and a third eventually becomes a felony in the 10-year period. We would be on the same type of model, and a simple assault works very similar. But here, you just lose the presumption. Now, the judge can still, within their discretion, still give the person probation on the third instance here. They just lose the presumption. It just gives the judge wider latitude. And so we believe that after a while, you know, there should be potentially some consequences, and you look harder and harder at these cases. You don't just have a presumption right off the bat as you continue to get multiple convictions for felonies, because I think we'll show this year, and we've talked about in the past, it's not just using drugs. It's burglaries. It's assaults. It's the other crimes that go with the use of methamphetamines. The shooting in Sioux Falls in the parking lot at the government center. The gentleman was coming at the police officer, and he was high on methamphetamines. They do feel invincible, and I think the officer acted very appropriately, and I've said so publicly with our report, but that's just one example. I think we can give you numerous examples of burglaries and different crimes that are going with the unfortunate use of methamphetamine.
So it goes back to this this prevention campaign, which the governor launched recently, this call during her state of the budget address, I believe. I might not have that correct, but, you know, for increased treatment facilities, and then this, you know, how do we enforce this better and more efficiently and more effectively? These all go together to help the person who's addicted, but also for public safety. Do I understand the big picture here?
Yes, I do believe you do. I've always asked for balanced approach. I mean, I talked about a meth treatment center. I mean, that's expensive, but I do believe that that still is something that's needed. The more treatment options we can have, the better. I think more awareness that we have is better. So, you know, the governor's ad campaign has, you know, brought more awareness to the methamphetamine problem. You know, I do talk to people all throughout the state, and they're like, is meth really that big of a problem? And yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And it affects every county in the state. There's not just, it's not just a Sioux Falls or Rapid City problem. It's all over. And we only busted 7 labs in 2018. I haven't got the 2019 statistics yet, but only 7 labs in state. Most all of these drugs are coming from out of state. Is actually coming from the cartels, predominantly from Mexico, and they're making it on an industrial level and just shoving it into America, and it's a volume game.
Mm-hmm. Which is, and it's a different method than it was in the days when people were cooking it abundance rurally.
Absolutely. It is, it's cheaper and it's more potent than you could make in your hometown garage meth lab.
And I want to go back to something you said about this sort of idea of cooperating. Because it's, I think everybody can kind of intuitively get right away of how that would help public safety and how it helps law enforcement. If someone cooperates, you can get the next person down the chain. How does it help the person who is trying to turn their life around? And this is more of a symbolic question than a procedural question, but
I think
there's an opportunity there as well.
I think it's also, it works both ways, because, I mean, if I'm a drug dealer and I know that this program's out there where they have to work with law enforcement, we at least think that we're going to have them think twice about, you know, can I trust this person? Because if he gets caught, he's going to turn me in. So we do think that there is a element of incentive and deterrence in that factor. And then right now, they literally can get out within 72 hours and they're back out, and they don't give us the information of their dealer, and they can go continue to use methamphetamines. Mm-hmm. So there's no incentive to turn in your dealer, because you're going to go out and get your high right away.
Yeah.
Well, if you, again, take it off the marketplace or make the marketplace harder for them to get it, that's also a way of helping them get off of methamphetamines. But I do believe that we need more treatment options.
The last time we actually spoke was a good year ago now.
Well, I've listened to a lot of your political junkies, I was going to admit, that through the years. So.
Tell me, you know, some of the things that kind of stand out from this first, and not all of them are things that you began, but, you know, we talked about the defeat of riot-boosting legislation, the recent court case about restriction legislation that was designed to restrict circulators of ballot question petitions. When you look back at the first year, what are some of the things that you say, hey, here's some of the successes of this agency and what I really want to highlight?
Well, I think we've had a lot of good information and a lot of good success story in the area of consumer protection. And that's a very broad category. Now, we don't talk, you know, presumptive probation and stuff gets all the headlines. You know, meth is more sexy a topic than, you know, talking about somebody's credit report, but that also affects people's lives. And I think, you know, we had the Equifax settlement this last year. We had a case we joined from the U.S. Supreme Court about trust issues, and I think that's a very big industry in our state that we've had success for. We're actually involved in another case regarding the Electoral College. It's not gotten a lot of press yet, and we're waiting for cert. We're working with Colorado in a bipartisan effort there. But I think that we've had a lot of great awareness. We came in, I said I wanted to update some things, such as we had a consumer protection handbook. It hadn't been updated in 5 years, and we've done that now, and getting that message out. We went to a lot of the fairs and things and handed that out and answered people proactively, and we're trying to get them to sign up for our newsletter and stuff and learn what the latest scams are. I mean, we're trying to push out information all the time about what the latest scams are and how they take advantage of people. We had the floods and stuff and blizzards, and who is there before the fire department's there, the scammers, and how can we take advantage of people in their lowest moment when they've lost everything, and we're trying to get that awareness out to people.
Okay.
And I think we've been very proactive in that area, and I think that consumer protection has been doing a very good job, but we're obviously involved in the opioid litigation. We're trying to help people in that front. That's a ongoing weekly thing that we're involved in, that I think we are going to make some progress, and we're going to get some relief back to the states from that, that either more medication where they can wean themselves off or other medications that they can use, and also some funding for treatment on that front. I think that's been a very positive development and not quite settled yet, but we're getting pretty close.
Let's close with more about the Electoral College effort that you mentioned. Tell me more
about
that.
Yeah. There's a case out of the 10th Circuit, Colorado. Their Attorney General is actually a Democrat, and I'm a Republican, but we've been working together. It was a case where somebody wanted to vote. They were bound to vote for Hillary Clinton, and he did not want to vote for Hillary Clinton, one of the electors. He wanted to vote for John Kasich of Ohio. They removed him from office, being an elector, and then he sued the state of Colorado. It was dismissed at the district level, and it went to the 10th Circuit, which said, yes, he can vote for anybody he wants to. And I think that we built a coalition of Republican and Democrat states. I have about 25 states that supported my brief to the United States Supreme Court, and we'll know either Friday or Monday, probably, if cert will be granted. But I think that's a way and an issue that everybody wants to know. It kind of goes back to what you brought up initially about the ERA. Everybody wants to know what the rules are and wants to know what the rules are fairly, not rewrite the rules 40 years later. Or here, in this case, I think everybody wants to know, in obviously a very contentious national election most likely, what the rules are going in versus having to decide on the back end once everybody has voted, you know, and having maybe another Bush versus Gore situation after the fact. I think everybody wants to know what the rules are. There was a Washington State Supreme Court that said, yes, they could be fined or have consequences against them. So we think that since there's a split between the circuits and one state Supreme Court, we have a pretty good chance of going to the Supreme Court.
Governor Kristi Noem says the state will not do business with entities that are involved in a campaign boycotting the state of Israel. Noem's executive order requires contractors and bidders to certify they are not participating in that campaign when contracting with the state. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Noem wields a blue pen as she signs an executive order that condemns anti-Semitism and stands against the Boycotts, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign, or BDS. The state becomes the 28th to pass a law or executive order. Noem focuses on the spiritual and national security relationship between the United States and Israel. She says the executive order will ensure that bids or state contracts are not awarded to those aligned with BDS activities. In the Capitol Rotunda following the signing of the executive order, Noem says the state will not tolerate, do business with, or have contracts with those that participate in those boycott activities.
The executive order is 3 pages long, but the real purpose is to say that if we will not knowingly enter into a contract with someone who is a part of that BDS movement, and if we find out afterwards that there is false certification, that we can break that contract as well.
BDS is a Palestinian-led movement that seeks to challenge international support for what they call Israeli apartheid and settler colonialism. Zoha Khalili is a staff attorney at Palestine Legal, which tracks anti-boycott efforts across the country since 2015. Khalili says actions like this penalize people who participate in boycotts of Israel that seek to promote Palestinian freedom and equality.
People are not engaging with the issue of the human rights violations that the Israeli government is engaging in, but they're trying to prevent people from engaging in advocacy around that issue or talking about that issue and passing different kinds of laws to scare people away from having those conversations.
The executive order certification applies to contractors and bidders who employ more than 5 people and who are contracting for goods or services that exceed $100,000. Executive orders are not laws, but have the same legal binding nature. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Josh, Lori Walsh, and Chris Loffery, I'm Steve Zwemke. Thank you for listening.